You are listening to Around Comics, episode 200.
200!
Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And yes. Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles,
Yes. Located
at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by.
Hey there, folks. The only guy on the panel who's revolving is Tom.
Yeah, that's because I spent all this money on this sweet, lazy Susan.
She might be lazy.
He's spinning.
But her name isn't Susan. Okay.
Hey there, folks. I'm Christopher Niesman, and riding alongside, as always, is Mr. Tom Caters.
Hello.
How you doing, buddy?
We're tied together forever.
I know. It's
on the internet, at least.
Well, I had to divorce Sal, and and so now it's you and me, Tom.
I Google my name, and your name comes up right next to him.
Yeah, you're his rebound co-host.
That's all right.
I'll move on to Hillary next.
Whoa.
Speaking of
sloppy thirds.
Mr. Hillary Barta, how you doing? Welcome back.
It's nice to be back.
I know, it's starting to turn into a nice little weekly appearance.
He said that with a question mark.
Oh, yeah.
I was about to say it was nice not to be here for a while, but that wouldn't have been polite. So.
Yeah. Exactly. That's how I feel.
Back from last week is Mr. Steve Bryant. How you
the
doing?
The illusion of editing.
We didn't just record that episode.
Oh, no. It's nice to know that Mark's going to let me out of Dark Tower after a week in the back with the gimp mask on.
I'm trapped in the Dark Tower. Help!
I have a question about you and Tom's relationship.
Yeah.
Does that make Vince be like your weekend girlfriend, or is it like a Fatal Attraction thing? Because I know he's all about your sexy podcasting pipes.
He's my side guy.
I wouldn't touch him. He's all Chris's.
Chris is a slut, obviously.
Talk about a bizarre love triangle.
Yeah, I am. I'm a podcast slut. It's getting kind of frightening.
Speaking of that, where else can we find you?
God, 11 o'clock comics every Thursday or Friday.
Look at that! I said it as a joke, and he's like, "This is a good opportunity."
Why miss an opportunity?
What's that salsa?
It's delicious. Tom Cater salsa. Spicy, mild, sweet, and sweet and sour.
And
my
drunk.
My favorite is the chocolate chip salsa.
Yeah.
That's your best recipe
chocolate
yet.
Chip candy salsa, everyone.
Nice. And the colorist for both Steve and Hillary on multiple projects.
I see this is coming together.
Rounding out the round table, Mr. Jason Malay.
Hi.
And also the fiancé of someone I went to high school with.
Yes.
Very
oddly enough.
I know.
Weird.
It is weird. It is kind of odd.
Yeah. Very small world.
I know. So anyone? So everyone?
What did you think of her in high school, Chris?
You don't remember her.
No, I do remember her.
Did she ever go to one of those strip mines?
No, this is where
you'd kill somebody and leave them in the strip mine.
I know. Chris was dating much younger at the time. I understand.
Oh, yes.
Gross. I don't even want to know how young. Come on to this strip mine.
This is really. I mean, I grew up like 7 hours. South of Chicago, and so it's not like this is a suburb of Chicago.
Small town, in Illinois.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that happens.
Very.
Don't worry,
very
folks. It gets more interesting later on.
Oh, comics, right?
The more
right,
you drink,
comics.
All right.
Speaking of small towns.
We remind everyone that this episode of Around Comics is brought to you by InStockTrades.com, where waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com offers a huge selection of the collected editions you need. InStockTrades is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 ship for free. And right now, InStockTrades is offering our new book club selection, Tom B. Land's True Story, Swear to God.
Oh, tough one for you, my friend.
Tom B. Land's True Story, Swear to God, Archive of Volume 1 for a fantastic 47% off the cover price. The first 17 issues of the six-time Eisner-nominated series are collected here for and available to you for a mere $10.59. And that
Wait,
is,
has he been nominated six times and not won?
Steve was nominated.
No, I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that's like Susan Lucci.
I was trying to think of the name.
He's the Susan Lucci.
Oh, boy. Wait, come on. He should win one. That's not bad. I'm just saying.
It's an honor just to be nominated.
It doesn't say Eisner Award winning. It is six-time nominated.
I'm
but,
just saying.
Hey, Steve was nominated.
I'm not dissing anyone who gets nominated. I've never been nominated for an Eisner.
Let's hope that never happens.
Hey, I had an inker of mine who was nominated, and he won. But I wasn't nominated as a penciler.
Night Fishing Fair.
You're mostly known as an inker. What's the tragic irony?
I did Plastic Man, someone inked me named John Nyberg, and he won as best inker.
Did you show up when he won?
I don't remember now if he won as the inker, but he was nominated. I never let him forget that.
And then Hillary kneecapped him. Like a miniature Batman.
I showed him, I never let him ink me again.
Yeah, I've never seen that guy ink after that. Yeah. He's in a strip club, or he's in a strip mine.
Or a strip club. Or a strip club. Yeah, you could do both.
He had to learn to pole dance.
John, if you're out there,
call
me.
I need help.
Well, hey, we have a colorist on the panel today.
He deserved the award. John's a great
actor. Oh, now you're backpedaling.
No, I mean, that wasn't the joke, okay? Wait, sorry, I'm wiping some marshmallow off my chin now.
I don't understand. What was the joke, that he didn't deserve it, or?
Just the irony, because Hillary's primarily an inker.
The irony. You know,
it's ironic on a number of levels, I think.
There's more. If John was here, he could tell us interesting stories about his an early job he had. He worked at a porno shop in DeKalb, Illinois, called The Grotto. Yeah.
Nice.
And the stories he told me about that place, hilarious. He'd have to mop up and back, you know, and the booths and everything.
Booths?
The booths, yeah.
No, okay. The booths, okay.
The booths. No, not the nudie booths. The guys would go in and... Yes. Oh, never mind. Gotcha. But anyway, back to small town.
And spill the
quickly.
Drinks.
Beverages. That's where he learned how to ink.
Wow, this came off the tracks really quick tonight.
Anyway,
so John, tell him you're out there. Call him.
What I wanted to kind of start off with tonight is we have Jason on the panel who has had the honor of coloring both Steve and Hillary's work.
It is an honor.
It occurred to me.
Set the bar a little higher there, pal.
It is an honor.
We haven't really talked about colorist on the show very often, and
if you invited them, maybe you'd talk about coloring.
I don't know that many colorists personally. Jason's one of the few colorists I know. There are some other great colorists that live in the Chicago area. I think Paul Mounts lives in the area. Scott Johnson, who colors more for Weissen's properties, but is still a very good colorist.
Scott's a painter.
Alex Ross is a pretty good colorist.
He colors well, yeah.
Does his own coloring, sure. But we just haven't talked about colorists that much on the show. So I figure it would be a chance.
You can't talk about magic.
First,
you can't ruin the illusion.
You can't put a rainbow in a jar, Chris. You can't teach someone how to put a color.
Chris is already thinking this was a bad decision talking about colors.
I don't even know why we're talking. Have you ever seen Jason Cook? He blindfolds himself, and he gets out just like a palette of colors, and just like puts it all on there. I don't even understand how it works. It doesn't matter.
Now's our chance to understand, Tom. Grab a hold of it. Understand.
I asked him once.
Grab the rainbow, Tom.
And then he broke into song.
I don't think a lot of people know the coloring process.
I kind of just want to keep listening to Tom here.
You can,
You're killing me, Caters.
It cracks me up because often when I'm talking to people who aren't in the business and you do comics, they'll say, I thought that was all done on computers now.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of your head drops, and then you kick them in the nuts and walk away.
The key command is F7 for make comic.
Most colors now, most colors work on the computer. I mean, yeah. I doubt there are too many that do watercolor sketches or marker drawings anymore.
Yeah,
probably.
I would doubt at this point. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know there's some pencilers and inkers who'll do like a marker comp and turn that over.
Because
there's one guy doing it right now who's like, oh, fuck.
You're on to me.
But, I mean, you know, at the beginning, you know, start of my career, you'd get the colorist would get a black and white photocopy, a reduced photocopy of your work, and then paint in watercolors. Sometimes they used markers, but often they used watercolors. And then they'd have to call out the colors.
They'd have to
code Y2R2 for each and every color, because that would go to the hand separators who would cut the acetone or whatever.
Really?
The ruby sheets.
You know what the process was like then?
I'm vaguely familiar, because as a kid it did seem like magic, and I would read about it without understanding it back then, and I'm glad that way of doing it is gone, because I think I still wouldn't understand.
And comics were called four-color comics because there were four plates. There was the black plate, and then
CMYKs.
Right.
Yeah. Cyan,
the
yellow,
blue,
magenta, and black. Which comics are still four-color process.
But the colorist would have to call out the percentages from each plate.
Damn.
The three plates, actually, usually not the black. And then, so Y2, yellow
black.
20%, you know, are... You know, red.
Well, and there was something 40%. Like 64 possible colors out of the percentages. Am I
right? Yeah, because there were only
and
certain combinations
coming up
you
with
could
the 65th
use.
One.
I did. Well, no. Neon chartreuse / green.
Yeah,
it's purple
red Malay.
Call Jason 65 Malay.
But they don't use that. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say, as the story goes, Marvel was getting more. You know where this is going?
I've heard. Yeah,
Marvel
yeah.
was getting more color combinations
in the 60s.
And Neil Adams went to Julie Schwartz,
Saul.
Who went to Saul Harrison.
Saul
somebody
Harrison,
went to Donenfeld and said, Marvel's getting, you know, 128 colors, and you only have 64 choices.
Yeah.
And so he called up the printer and, you know, what the hell's this? And suddenly Neil let DC get twice as many colors.
For no extra money.
That was a really interesting story in my head, and then I started saying it, and I just...
Well, Neil tells it so much better and so much more often. I've heard that story a lot, and I'm sure it's true, and I find it interesting, but still really abstract to me. Like, I don't... completely grasp.
Understand having that limited of a color palette.
Yeah,
because, you know, the way, and I work in printing, and it's like four-color process is four-color process. The only thing, whenever I was coming up, the only limitation was your line screen. Today's coloring process, you're not calling out colors and percentages. Everything's done on the computer, and it's done in CMYK is the color palette that you're using, but there are literally millions of colors that you can choose from. It's just how well they're going to reproduce. What is your coloring process? Now, understanding that your color palette is pretty much unlimited now, which is a difference between today's comics and comics from 20, 30, 50 years ago.
I mean, I work in layers, and as I understand it, more and more people are starting to work in layers. When I first was talking to colorists maybe 7 or 8 years ago, a friend of Steve's and mine, a great colorist named Chad Fiddler, showed us some things, and he worked in channels, and channels still kind of befuddle me. But layers, I just, you know, you set up essentially what your black line becomes transparent, so it's like a black line of an animation cell, and then you paint the color underneath that, and it shows through, and they can get into what I set the layers at.
And talking in layers and channels, this is all Photoshop talk. Your primary tool is Photoshop, correct?
With a little, and that's when you're talking about working in CMYK, when I started to get into Painter a bit more, to where I go back and forth between Photoshop and Painter, I found I was working in CMYK, which is how you have to usually deliver the finished artwork to the company. And I was bringing it into Painter, and I was getting these radical color distortions. Well, I found out that, surprisingly.
Technical term, isn't it?
It's like a
tubular term.
Totally tubular and radical, yes. Actually, no, I was just teasing Joanne last night for all the totally she uses, so I deserve that. But what I found was Painter only works with RGB. Right. And so ever since then, I just work RGB, and then I switch over to CMYK as the very last step. And then there's a certain amount of color tweaking that has to go on because everything becomes a lot less pretty.
Yeah. Whenever you switch, and this is very techy, geeky stuff. But
I was going to say, you'll keep us away from too much of the techy stuff.
Whenever you change color modes, it does change on the screen and what you're
printing.
Someone
who knows nothing about drawing, inking, or coloring, the thing that always fascinates me when I think about someone coloring something is like, so you receive a page that is simply black and white. How do you even start? Let's say you have like, you receive a page, and let's assume for the sake of simplicity that it's focused on like one panel.
Right.
Let's say it's like two people like in a restaurant, and all you have are black and white lines. Like, where do you even start?
A lot of times I'll ask, Hillary what he's thinking.
Are you getting the script that goes along with the pages?
It's funny, I always want the script, but there's sometimes where I have to ask for the script, and a lot of times I'm not really sure if this scene is a day or a night without a script. Sure. Sometimes I don't know why. I've heard some inkers say that they never look at a script, but it seems like if you're a colorist, to do it without a script, you're going to miss something, you're going to have to redo it.
It's really bright in this bar.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 4 a.m, and yet you have the sun setting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you found that different writers will pay a lot of attention to colors? I've heard about this, that some writers are very specific about the colors that they want in certain scenes. And there are some books that, you will see changes from like a very, very red, warm palette to a very blue, cool palette, that has a very big effect on the story.
Because as we're talking with Steve and Hillary, who are here, they're both artists, and they usually have something of a concept. Although sometimes less of one than another, but like the Rex Mundi stuff that just mm-hmm. came out, there's very little color notes given. I mean, they're fun scripts to read because they're very colloquial and very much like just chatting. And but you do get time, you do get place, you do get material sometimes. Like this is a marble floor, a lot of it's taking place in a hotel. And mm-hmm. So there's not specific like color direction has to make this whole scene shades of red, but if he says sunset, you can kind of infer, why don't I use this chance to use some red notes throughout the next two pages or something like that.
Once again, coming from like someone who doesn't know anything about art, as far as like being a colorist, where's sort of the area that you would put your stamp on it that would make it look like your stuff as opposed to?
Or is I'm not sure I want to do that.
Oh, yeah, or is there an area, I mean, unintentionally or intentionally, like, even unintentionally, where is the space in sort of coloring that people sort of develop their own.
Yeah, it's like Dave Stewart.
I was going to say,
is kind of the guy. I mean,
we've talked about Dave Stewart, and Hillary and I talk about Dave Stewart all the time. And he's one of the
few people that whenever you open up a book,
right.
that it's like, wow, okay, Dave Stewart colored this book, and you flip back and it's like, yep, it's Dave Stewart. It's one of the few people that is almost instantly recognized. And why is it recognizable?
It's interesting though, because the way he does it though does not overpower the artist he's working with. He'll use similar palettes at times, but if you just look at the different Dark Horse books he does, there must be a couple dozen of them, but he'll use a similar palette for a lot of the Hellboy books. But depending on the line art, he'll take a brushier approach, or he'll take a completely flat approach with Mignola, and it serves the art. And yet, at the same time, it's Dave Stewart. Which is a pretty amazing line to mm-hmm. kind of balance on, but he seems to do it every single time.
Is it palette? Okay. Do people have distinctive?
He changes his palette when the job calls for it. He's incredibly versatile, and sometimes like I won't know if he's doing a slicker style. I won't know it's Dave Stewart, but I'll know I really like the color. And then
you look at it and he's just like, Dave Stewart.
I'll go, oh, that was Dave Stewart. Yeah, okay.
Well, he's got a really good color sense. So
he does.
It's not the same as a penciler or an inker. You know, you're not looking at the lines, though I suppose some colors you might recognize the way they cut the color and pattern it and stuff. But mostly you're looking at their color choices. You know, why, you know, they put this color next to that color, next to that color, and that brings out something different than another color would use a slightly different shade of green or whatever, and get the same effect.
When you're sort of learning the technique of coloring, is it like a lot of trial and error in a way? What goes into knowing?
It's a lot of trial and error, and I started kind of dabbling around with color.
Is there a lot of color theory that you
with? And I every Saturday I'm painting 6 hours with oil paint, and I think that's helped a lot. I just started doing the digital coloring about 4 years ago, and I think my understanding of color theory has improved a lot, but I feel like it can improve a lot more. And so I tend to read a lot more books on color theory and painting than comic books these days. So less fun reading.
Less fun. It brings more to the table, probably.
But who are some of the colorists that you really look up to that are working in comics today?
Well, we mentioned Dave Stewart. There's the first guy I looked at, and I really just fell in love with his work was Chad. We both always loved Chad's work, but
Chad Fiddler.
Chad Fiddler, and but a person I didn't know it
Chad
was
Fiddler on the roof.
Yes, that okay. Chad Fiddler, that very one, and. it was when I was doing some freelance work at Devil's Due, and they had a guy named Sundar Raj who colored a number of their books, and the guy was just
Sundar Raj 2000.
Oh, nice, thank you.
And
what is it with you and the Raj 2000 references?
There's nothing wrong with a Raj.
There's nothing. Yeah, he's right. If it feels good, do it.
So, and I just I think he went into video games, but he just had this really sort of painterly approach that Dave Stewart I then noticed was doing something similar in Conan, and I went, oh, I really want to try this. And God, I'm trying to think names. I mean, there's so many Eisenhove and Haberlin. I mean,
well, it's nice that we're to a point. I mean, Maury Hallwell, obviously.
Lots of good ones.
It's nice that I can't remember a time in comics where there's been as much attention or name recognition with colors. You've got like Dave McKay, Matt Hollingsworth, Laura Martin.
Right.
You know, we talked about Val Staples' work on Brit and some other stuff.
Criminal.
It's kind of nice that Proof?
Yeah.
Is Val Staples?
He's doing now Proof.
What? Okay.
Yeah. It looks like I know more.
There you go.
Sorry, I win.
Scott Chandler on Hawaiian Deck. Is it Stephen Griffin?
Griffin does the colors.
See? I know more.
Wait, it was
Jesus
what's
Christ.
What's Chandler doing?
What the fuck do you know?
Artist.
I think he's taking over the drawing show. Stephen Griffin did the original art and line art and colors, and then when he stopped doing the line art, he continued to do the colors, and that's why it's still so.
I always get the two.
I really like how it looks now, though. Too like the most recent series, I really like the line art with the coloring. No, I'm sorry.
No, it's one of my favorite books, so I just.
But it's nice that with the expanded palettes, with the technology, that you have colors that have different styles that impact books. I mean, we talked about Maury Hallwell. Mm-hmm. It's Steve McNiven, good artist. Steve McNiven with Maury Hallwell on colors, completely different. It helps define the look.
Steve Epting and Dermata.
Yeah. Do you ever, when you're coloring something, is there a balance between
Are you still speaking as someone who doesn't know anything about art or color?
No, I now know. I now know a little bit about color.
Okay. He's been educated.
I know a lot about art just recently. I'd read a book. This episode is actually recorded over 2 days.
Okay, Tom. I just didn't know because time had passed.
We didn't. Yeah, exactly. You need to keep a narrative.
You were clean-shaven when we started.
Yeah, exactly. Now I have like a foot-long beard.
What?
Are you ever concerned about overpowering someone's stuff with color?
Yeah, I
too much pink? drink, perhaps?
Yeah. Or just like
you do try things every now and then.
One thing I noticed with sometimes with coloring in books is sometimes people get really like over rendery with colors and like
I can
flares and like everything's shiny and everything.
When the computers first came in, a lot of people were coloring only because they knew how to use a computer, you know, or knew how to use Photoshop, but they didn't know any color theory. There's still some of those people out there, but there's a little more demand for actual color theory.
Wasn't that one of the big knocks on Dark Knight Strikes Back?
Yeah.
Was that it was one of the first times that computer coloring had been used, and it was way over the top, way oversaturated.
It had been used.
It had been used for a while, but I think it was the first job that we saw Lynn Varley use.
Okay,
and it was really
she had come from a very traditional painterly background.
Okay, yeah, I knew it was new in Wonders, but maybe it was Lynn Varley's first attempt.
Coming from someone who doesn't know anything about art, I didn't think it looked that great. But that's just me.
Now, from the writer side, and I don't ask you how much attention do you spend in your scripting, in your scripts to color? I mean, are you saying, hey, this needs to be, you know, this color palette, or I'm looking for this feel? Do you give instructions to your colorist?
Very rarely, when I'm writing or penciling, or you know. Pretty much now that I'm writing, penciling, and inking, the extent of what I need to specify is just day or night. And if I think something would look cool, and I've done this with Chad and with Jason, I'll just say, here are my thoughts, but I know that you're going to be able to do this far more elaborately than me, but here's what I'm thinking. And sometimes they follow it, and sometimes they ignore it completely and say,
I had a better idea.
I thought this would work better, but I can change it. And, you know, 999 times out of 1,000, they're right.
Now, one of the things that Hillary and Jason, you guys work together. Jason... Actually, like you're beating Jason up, but you commented whenever we were out talking a couple weeks ago or whatnot that you enjoy the fact that you and Jason live in fairly close proximity to each other, that you're able to go over and then choke him like a
bunk beds.
When it comes
actually,
something badly, just smacks me on the fact that
do you
live in cardboard boxes, everything's close. So
you just cut out a window.
Yeah, but, getting a mic close here, Tom.
But you remarked that it was nice because instead of coming up with a bunch of elaborate directions and emailing back and forth, that you can just go over and kind of look over his shoulder and bother him.
If you're not in the same neighborhood, you're essentially emailing or making long phone calls or you know. And that gets frustrating because the communication is delayed. If you're just sending an email, you might send a bunch of notes, and then you see the colors, and then you send notes in response, and then da-da-da. But if you're talking it out, a lot of stuff that, you know, I can say, oh, this is what I'm looking for, or this is what I wanted, or this is what I'm thinking about, or I can just say, well, what do you think? And we can sort out whether some of those initial ideas work. I mean, I'm not a colorist. I don't really have a good sense of color theory. And I end up being that guy who says, I don't know what I want until I don't see it, you know, and then I have to complain about, no, this isn't right.
So you're coming from a place of someone who doesn't know anything about color.
So does Jason still answer the door when he looks through the people and sees
you? All the lights go off.
Jason screens all of his calls, so...
I don't think that's you.
Jason is in when he wants to be in.
No, it's not you or me.
But I know, Jason has said he enjoys talking through the colors and working on stuff.
I enjoy talking about colors.
Please let my family go.
No, but whatever you want.
Well, I remember in the old days. I mean, when I wasn't, you know, when the colorist didn't live 10 minutes away, I remember sending a story to somebody, and the only note I had for the colorist is I said, "Make it look like a Technicolor movie." And by that I meant I wanted it to be lush, but kind of, a palette that, you know, evoked an old era because I was doing a story that kind of had a 1940s kind of feel. And I don't know if it looked like that when it came out, but the guy just ran with some pretty vivid colors. You know, it was Joe Rosas. And there it looked like everything was airbrushed. Yeah. I don't know what he was using, but there was a lot of kind of airbrushy stuff. That was in the earlier days of computer color.
Okay. So it was digital.
It was digital.
Yeah, because your stuff, the color plays a huge role. I mean, in all colored comic art.
Well, you were around before there was any color, period.
Yeah. Well, I mean, was the world black and white?
The reason I don't know anything about color theory is because there wasn't color when I was born. It hadn't been invented yet.
You were born into a black and white world.
There was a horror story done at Harvey Comics, Howard Nostrand or Bob Pollinger in the 50s, where like the color is drained out of the story, and then it goes all black. It's pretty cool. It's called Colorama. Anyway, sorry, where were we? Well, oh, yeah, that's right, I'm old. Okay.
Right, the Hillary Barter is old. Yeah. No, but it is nice that Hillary can come over that way, because it's kind of like a lot of times we'll have conversations where Hillary will kind of say, well, if we try this, and then I'll just start doing it. And he'll go, no, I was just throwing it out there. I was just thinking, like, I'm like, it'll take me
right,
a minute.
It feels like but it feels like he's jumping, you know, like I'm barking commands, and all of a sudden he's made that guy red right in front of me. I'm like, no, you're going to ruin it. And he's like,
I can throw it out if it doesn't work.
Command Z.
Yeah, I'm on a layer. I can toss it out. If it doesn't work, right. Let's try it.
It's an adjustment layer, Hillary. Relax.
Exactly. That's what I'm doing. So, you know.
So, right. Make your magic devil box, take it back.
Actually, there is a lot of ooing and aahing coming from me when I'm watching Jason work the computer, because half, you know, I did color a few things. And I hated the process because it was so slow for me working with the computer. And Jason can just do this stuff like so fast. He's like, looks like he's doing six things at once. You crazy kids.
Well, when you see things through Jason's eyes, there's just like green code streaming in front of him all the time.
The Matrix.
I've heard about flatters before. Mm-hmm. Are there still flatters?
There are, yeah.
You look
yeah.
very sharp today, Chris.
I'm flattering.
Yeah, no, actually, I don't know. Actually, if you saw the Munden's Bar story that Hillary that just went up on Comic Mix.
Go to comicmix.com, Munden's Bar.
I have a. got that.
Very good. Very good.
My flatter for a lot of work. Lives up in Wisconsin, and she said it was the scariest story she's ever seen in the history of comic books. It just creeped her out more than not just anything she had ever flatted, but anything she had ever read. Which I think is quite a compliment, really.
Inappropriately touched by a comic book.
Show me on the doll.
She's lying in her room in the fetal position, book's over there.
Go to comicmix.com. So you can be creeped out just like Jason's flatter.
If you want to be molested by a comic book, comicmix.com.
Don't let's start. This is the worst part. To believe for all the world that you are my precious little girl. But don't let's start. I've got a weak heart and I don't get around. How you get around?
It was a roundabout way of saying that I use flatters.
Okay.
What is a flatter?
It's someone who doesn't know anything about coloring.
It would be basically someone that just lays in flat blocks of colors that separates pieces in a comic panel so that you can just go in, select each piece, and render on top of that.
Your modeling on top of the flat color.
A lot of times there's like a cuts layer.
So the flats would be like Superman's cape is red.
Exactly. The S in that is yellow.
Right, okay.
Right. So that kind of thing. And,
though sometimes they just use all gray or
all
whatever, because they're
yeah.
just separating the shapes,
right.
You know, so that you can hit your color into them. They're not choosing the color.
I had one flatter who would use intentionally neon colors, because a lot of colorists don't want to have their choices affected by what the flatter put in. So if you have these horrible neon colors, you're not going to use them, but it's still separated fine. I mean,
but you
They
them.
Look.
You used them.
A couple of them snuck through. They're fine.
I used them.
I think
pink came through once. Yeah.
The Pepto page.
I use
it. It's more of a reddish orange now. Well, and this was something like Hillary has a I guess a prejudice against the pink, and I challenged that prejudice the other day, and I knew I was getting into.
My prejudice won.
It's prejudice won. But I'm like, I know, I'm just trying something here. I'm pretty sure what your reaction is going to be. But it was one of those things where you're just kind of watching and see if the jaw drops. And yeah, the jaw kind of went,
no. No. So, no, that's not going to work.
So, but, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Exactly. Control Z. Want to switch gears and talk about another process of making comic books that I think gets misunderstood by a lot of people whenever you hear the words.
I want to see what
Tom, I think it's especially misunderstood by Tom.
I don't.
Because he doesn't know anything
about art or coloring.
You're kind of like unfrozen caveman lawyers.
Tom doesn't know anything about process. So
yeah, what is this?
We hear about photo referencing a lot in comic books.
Crutches, yeah.
Hey, swipes, man.
Research.
Well, there's a difference between a swipe and a photo reference.
Having recently been thawed out of ice, I don't understand what a photo is. What do you mean?
Or this color you've been speaking of.
But one of the things that Steve is doing up in Chicago this weekend, you are doing a shoot for photo reference material.
I was a zombie.
Were you a zombie?
This is like podcast for dummies tonight.
It is. Someone who doesn't understand.
I don't understand. Podcast. Can you explain the process to me? What's this casting we're doing?
I see this a lot. That people, you know, on the internets, when people hear photo referencing, their first reaction is someone has opened up a magazine and traced this, or they found this picture in another comic and they are referencing this from, you know, a copyrighted material. But that's not always the case in photo referencing. There are a lot of artists that will take photos of scenes to use them as quote unquote reference for what they're drawing in panels. Now, you rely not heavily, but you use a lot of reference material in the work that you do. Can I explain why you do that and what the process of photo referencing is?
Explain yourself.
Okay. You have 30 seconds.
And
Tom will understand.
And what the difference between that and swiping
is. Keep it simple.
Is.
Well, keep it simple.
I think, first of all,
what?
There's no one way to
not
use
that simple.
There's no one way to use photo reference.
Okay.
You can turn them upside down. You can flip them over.
I got nothing. No, but I mean, it can be anything from you pencil everything out of your head and you're looking at it to shore up the way that a hand is drawn or facial structure or folds in a shirt or whatever. It can go from that to the guy that shoots reference, looks at the reference and draws it, eyeballing it, to the guy that's lightboxing it and then cartooning on top of it, to the guy that's just doing a full-on lightbox. I mean, and there can be mixtures and combinations of that, or you can just use it to swipe a car or an airplane or stuff like that.
I'm always cartooning on top of it. My girlfriend tells me to stop, but I can't help myself.
And then you say, once I get started, it's just best to let me finish.
Cartooning!
Is that what you're calling it now?
But, I mean, is that a pretty accurate assessment of all the different ways that it can be done? It's not just one way.
Right. I mean, you can look out your window and do photo referencing.
What
does
a car look like?
I've done that. I'm drawing a street scene, and I go, oh, I don't want to draw the same car six times in a row, and there's an SUV, and I'll get the general shape, and then I'll just make the rest of it up.
Or, yeah, referencing, I used to have, when I was married, I'd have my wife come in and, okay, stand this way and do this, or hold this. She always fell for that one.
She won't come over anymore?
No.
Hold this.
She got married today, so there you go.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Did you photo reference that?
No, I hightailed it up to Chicago.
I got your reference right here, pal.
To take pictures of a 24-year-old girl in tights.
So you're free.
I think I got the better end of the deal.
You're free and clear now, is what you're
Yeah, pretty much. So,
no, yeah.
Can we set up an account, Steve, at Round Comics?
Nice.
Steve.
What was the subject line, dating?
Well, when you start to build up your photo reference library for an issue,
good complexion. And he likes dogs.
Steve's
not like that.
Steve's a good looking guy. I mean,
he is.
Stop. Okay, so.
Well, that's not weird. Come on. What?
Stop touching my leg, Tom.
So you've got
you've got a new
Athena Voltaire story coming out, and you need to get your photo reference library together. What's your process? Are you doing thumbnails of each page and say, okay, I need to shoot these specific scenes so I can get them, you know, anatomically correct, blah blah blah.
Well, previously I just kind of cobbled stuff together from, you know, shooting my ex-wife. No, shooting friends and just doing, like, not much in the way of lighting and stuff like that. But a mutual friend of Jason and mine, Gary Carbon, who's a terrific painter, really goes, like, all out on his photo reference. And I really admired Al Williamson's 1960s Secret Agent X9 strip. Not just 60s. He did it from 67 to 80. And Williamson really photo referenced the hell out of that thing. And I mean, when he photo referenced it, he was still drawing. It was still looked like Williamson people. There was still a lot of interpretation of what he was doing. So mm-hmm. I wanted to try to move more into that area of photo referencing, kind of try to pick up Gary's method, see how much of it works for me, and, you know, just move on like that. So I didn't quite lay out every scene, just because it was on short notice. We didn't have a lot of people to stand in, like a different person for every character.
I've been a ninja. I've been involved.
Well,
you
guys stood in on a job that ended up getting canceled because of, you know, me parting ways with Paul Daly.
I was a great ninja, so you guys
were
awesome.
You were a kick-ass ninja. Yeah. Not as good as Mike's dog, who coincidentally is named Ninja.
He's got an advantage, though.
It was still letting Gary set up light sources and stuff like that, which was more elaborate than the way I've done it before. It's going to be a fun learning process. I don't know if I may try to go even more that direction. I may back off of it. It depends on how much fun it is.
I was going to ask, do you, in using that sort of method of photo reference, do you find yourself drawn towards, like, backing off of it or going more into it, or do you become when you mentioned, I can imagine trying to draw a hand can be difficult, like holding something, because that's not something necessarily that in the natural process of learning how to tell a story. Hillary knows it from the
beginning of 2001.
You can learn the fundamentals of telling a sequential story, but that doesn't necessarily mean you know how to draw a hand like holding a book. After you've seen enough hands holding books, do you become more comfortable with that, and then you sort of move on to something else, or do you become more comfortable with being looser with that, or I'm just curious about how do you become dependent on it? Do you become freer from it once you sort of get used to doing it again and again?
Well, some guys are going to say that it's crutches. Other guys are gonna, Neil Adams has a great bit where he says one of the greatest learning tools that you can do is to trace photographs.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably one of those things, just like whatever vision you have in your head of what you want something to look like. What's going to work for Jason or for Hillary or for me or, you know, for Mike Norton or Chris Burnham or whatever, it's everybody's results are gonna be different because of how your brain is processing stuff.
Well, what's the final product? I mean, if you want, for certain more illustrative styles, the closer you get to the realistic end of the spectrum of drawing, the more you're going to use photo reference, the more it makes sense to use it. It doesn't mean that the most cartooniest of artists don't ever use it, but they're going to look at it and then just internalize it and then draw it their own way.
I was going to ask you about the American Splendor story and photos.
Yeah, I did. The story was set in Chicago, and I was riding around the bike. It was called Chicago Visit. Harvey comes to Chicago, Harvey Picar. And so I did photo reference. I went to his friend's house. They were featured in the story. I visited various businesses that they went to. And then I'd sort of have to pose these characters that weren't present anymore in those environments. It was kind of, you know, it was fun. But that's not what I typically do, so it was a little difficult. You know,
I suppose there's situations where you have to. If you have a story set in a certain city, you have to. It has to.
Well, you don't have to. It's sort of like an old TV show that's set in France, and every show in the 60s was filmed on a back lot in Hollywood, and so there's the fake French street. And
I almost think now, though,
English street.
It depends. Like a book like Local that Brian Wood and Ryan Kelly did, one of their big things with that book was that he wanted to make all the locations that they went to look like
very
that
accurate,
place. So
yeah.
you can't sort of make shit up. He has to have photo. He has
to do it. Yeah. To do it to follow through with their premise.
Yeah, he has to.
I think
know
I,
what the city. Looks
I think
like.
I asked him that in at Wizard. It was a very very fanboy question.
Oh, do you know how great it was that
it was,
you did that?
It was the Wicker Park episode that had just come out for Local, and it was that point in the story was supposed to be set it was supposed to be set in Wicker Park in like 1992 or something like that, or not 92, like 98,
so
whatever.
So Starbucks wasn't there.
Well, yeah, it was like 10 years ago, and I asked him if he had gotten reference from Wicker Park 10 years ago. Now, Wicker Park, for anyone that doesn't know Chicago, is a neighborhood that has changed dramatically.
There's a lot of fucking stroller stores there.
Yeah, I mean, this used to be a fairly seedy neighborhood that kind of turned into a the artist community in Chicago.
Now it's
MTV Real World.
Yeah. And so the neighborhood has changed dramatically over the last 10 or 15 years.
It's like changed three times.
Yeah,
like 10,
yeah. And I asked him if he had gotten reference from when the year that she was actually supposed to be living in Wicker Park. And I think the answer was something along the lines of, well, no, not really, but I don't think it's changed that much. And I was like, well, no, it has.
Well,
so that issue sucks.
Not just talking about reference in that regard, but you look at someone like Bern Hogarth, who famously didn't use reference. His figure work is great because he knew it so well, but if you see a Bern Hogarth car or gun...
Yeah, but Bern Hogarth's figures aren't real figures.
Right, well, exactly. But
they're stylized figures. I mean, he learned how to draw the figure his way. And
but I think it applies well on his cars.
Yeah.
I mean on his figures. But his cars, when he's trying to do those figures set in a contemporary situation, and he's got these fucking rocket cars with, you know.
But really, it's the same thing. And we accept it with the figures. Where you go, oh, that's his style of drawing a figure. But you don't expect it when you see a car or a building or, you know, when he just...
People are more forgiving with
artistic license
and
figures.
Figures, I think, because they're used to seeing artistic.
Well, I mean, I think so much of the superhero cliches have come out of Hogarth. I mean, you look at, like, I mean, Hogarth invented a lot of the way the serratus muscle is abbreviated by cartoonists ever since then and things.
Right.
And
the little Z that runs down the rib cage.
Right, and you look at how Hogarth did those.
That's
things.
That's not Cap's chainmail?
They've been used ever since. But I've always looked at his figures as if, and you do see this in a lot of superhero figures to this day, where there's this feeling that they're being electrocuted. Like, you know, I always say I think there'd be a puddle of urine under a Bern Hogarth figure because it's being, you know, everything is stressed and tensed.
Right. Every muscle was delineated. I wish I knew who did it, but someone did a parody of the Hogarth action figure, the dynamic, you know, Tarzan.
Dynamic.
And it was like Tarzan having breakfast. So he was dramatically eating breakfast, you know, splashing the milk into the cereal bowl and thrusting the spoon into his mouth or whatever he was doing. And it was, you know, it was absurd. But anyway,
of course it's absurd. Tarzan doesn't eat cereal.
That's just silly.
What's wrong with you?
He eats jungalows. What are you talking about?
Continuity error, my friend.
But talking about the muscles and the popping and
well, but it's a stylization, and when you recognize the stylization on something like a car, and you go, gee, that doesn't look like a car today. Yeah. I find it very difficult to draw modern cars because they don't tend to appeal to my eye. The 1940s, 30s, and 50s have much more sort of artistic, individual designs.
Character.
They a better line to the hand. Yeah. Well, there's a different line. They're more intricate now in many ways because they can do so much more with computer modeling. But they're not as easy to draw. They just don't kind of fly, you know, off the hand.
Do they not have as simple of a visual style in a way? Like
in some ways, I think those cars were more like direct fantasy projections onto the, you know, design
page.
Like
if you saw a silhouette of an old car.
Well, they literally had rockets and, yeah, you know, fins, yeah, and, you know, they and am I talking too loudly?
No.
I'm actually turning Tom.
So they had all, they had, as someone who doesn't know anything about cars.
color cars?
They come in many colors.
Well, because they weren't around when we were frozen.
Yeah, I'm scared by these gasoline
these
horses.
These horseless carriages.
These gasoline horses.
What's a carriage? The wheel?
I do not understand what this means.
Anyway, we were talking
fins.
Hogarth.
I think photo referencing, we somehow...
Yeah.
No, that's good, man.
No, but it's just, yeah, style versus realism, where, you know, and every artist is stylized. You were saying, how do you, you know, where do you put your imprint into the colors? You were asking Jason about that earlier. Well, you do, in a way, your color choices, you know, you can be trained and all that, but... Maybe you wouldn't tell by every panel or every page, but eventually, the innate style, your sort of signature, your personality, like, will come out, and it comes out in your drawing, it comes out in your writing, it comes out in your color. These colors appeal to you,
right,
and so you'll use them more often. You'll find combinations to use them,
and probably rationalize to yourself afterwards why they appeal to you. But
I'd like to learn why.
It's pink. Laying on the couch with your therapist, you know, she will explain to you why pink is so important to you.
Yeah. I don't know.
Why do you keep trying to use pink in this fucking story? It doesn't fit.
Well, because it takes place on Mars, the red planet.
Red, not the pink planet.
Why are those giant phallic mushrooms pink, Jason?
Well, I wanted to go back to a photo reference thing real quickly, because I know that you and I'm pointing at Hillary, but I know that we kind of fall on different ends of the spectrum.
You're pointing to Santa Claus, who's silently sitting behind.
And he's wearing pink because somebody bleached out his suit.
I know what you're about to say.
No. I mean, there's also photo reference abuse. Now, I'm thinking that your line for where it's abusive is probably at a different place than mine, but there are those guys that, and Jason and I have talked about this, that can't actually draw, that think, I can do what Tim Bradstreet does. But because they don't know what they're drawing, they can't compensate for what's wrong with the photo.
Okay.
Or they can't...
Distortion.
Maybe they can do a good front view, but when they turn the figure or cock a head back or something like that, they don't understand what they're drawing with the nose. And that's... You know, the common misconception is anyone can trace a photo, but it's... If you're looking at a photo or if you're lightboxing it or whatever, the goal is to refer to it, reference, rather than and interpret, rather than just if you're just going to try to reproduce what's in the photo, you might
use
as well.
The photo.
Well, like just posterize it.
What you just made me think of is in animation, they used to use, well, they still do,
rotoscoping,
right? And in films that combine actual drawn animation, like a classic thing like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the dwarves were all animated. That is, artists drew them, they designed the characters, and they animated them freehand. And then those characters would interact with characters that were traced from filmed characters. They were traced right down onto the cells.
Yeah, like Snow White.
Snow White and the Prince Charming or whatever. And they move differently. The rotoscope characters feel stiffly. Even though they move like real people, there's more life. And what we're talking about here is a level of stylization. Those photos, and typically in rotoscoping, or when they're done badly, like in a movie, you know, Ralph Bakshi's
Lord of the Rings,
or something, where
that's where I thought you were going.
Out of stylization, you know, you get this sort of what looks like a piece of film, you know, in silhouette. It looks like bad drawing. because it somehow isn't reimagined, it isn't integrated into the drawing process.
Well, and that's one of the dangers with, you know, whenever someone is just trying to interpret, not even interpret, but lightbox or trace what is in the photo, because, first of all, whoever you're going to shoot for the reference, probably their concept of acting is just holding a pose. When you know, when you're watching a movie, when someone is doing a laugh, you're seeing their them throw their head back. You're getting the audio. You're getting the movement. If you were to just freeze that person in one place, the chances are the pose would not be exaggerated enough to convey it as a comic. So you either have to tell your model to overact, or you have to look at the photo and you have to push it, or you have to do both, because otherwise you're going to end up with a very sterile picture.
Well, I think, to me, when I hear photo referencing as someone who doesn't know anything about photos or referencing,
or art, or color,
or anything after the caveman
era,
the thing that concerns
me the most about it is there are times, I think it's interesting you brought Bradstreet, because there's times where this happens with him that sort of bothers me. It happens with other guys. I'm thinking of Greg Land, especially, where I see certain heavily photo reference stuff that can textually within the story or where it is, it looks nice, especially with Bradstreet, but I don't think it fits, or it's like so out of context of the story that it's in. Well, Land, I think, is really bad with the fact that in stories, people will scream something, will be yelling, but their mouths will be closed, or their mouths will look like they're yelling, but they're asking, like, pass me the salt, but it looks like they are screaming it, and it doesn't.
Well, they are screaming. They really want the salt.
Well, there's a salt issue with Bradstreet where
this food
woman,
is terrible.
The woman on the
pass
cover
me the salt.
The woman on the cover is holding like nunchucks, which doesn't have anything to do with the story. You know, it's like this way, and it looks really nice. And I don't doubt his ability to put it, interject.
Hey,
his
man,
own.
Greg Land was drawing the shit out of stuff when he was doing CrossFit and stuff. I mean, he is a talented artist. My only concern
is that there's a context level at times that I think when people get too into it, all of a sudden you're a step away from the story, and then when you really look at it and you look at all the pieces, there's a problem, because you have this picture that kind of fits, but not really.
That's also a connection between the writing, you know, the script and the art, and you never know how that happens, because you know, if an artist gets a script, there's no excuse. But if they get a plot, and they draw it, and then the writer
puts
that scream into the mouth of someone who's just yawning or whatever.
Yeah.
That's not.
Well,
the
I mean,
fault,
that might be unfair of me to say that.
No, but you never know that part of it.
Or if the editorial direction for the cover description is
putting up chucks
on the cover. Give me a woman and make her look badass. And so Tim thought, well, numb nut chucks. If a woodchuck could chuck wood, look badass. And
because like the concern is from someone, from a fan point of view, is you look at it.
I think you get numb nuts from the nunchucks.
Yeah.
If you don't swing them right, you're nuts or you're chucks.
Just from a fan point of view, when you're looking at the final product, and you look at that, you look at it and go,
is she going to fight somebody with that?
Or no, you look at it and go, he had a picture of someone with nunchucks, and he did that. Yeah. Because you're just looking at it from the end point in comparison to what you have. Or you're looking at Greg Land's drawing in comparison. You're just looking at that
right.
final product.
I can see where you're going with
that. You're saying is like, this doesn't fit, because you're only seeing the end. And of course, it could be anybody's fault at any point.
Well, I mean, that's a lot of what we're talking about today.
That's why photo referencing gets that bad. Because it's easy blame. Because it's easy for me to say, well, Bradstreet had a picture with someone with nunchucks, and that's what he did. Because that's the easiest in my mind to tie together why I'm confused about why that happens.
And, well, like with Greg Land.
I think editors are crazy.
Well, with Greg Land, I still don't understand.
Tom's currently looking for a job at Comic.
Well, I don't understand what happened to Greg Land from a fan perspective.
Yeah.
Because when he was doing Sojourn,
he changed a lot.
Well, I almost think he was disproportionately praised, and I think now he's just disproportionately demonized. Exactly, because
stuff still sells, man.
Oh yeah, but I don't think he was ever. You know, for a while, his star
wasn't
was
that big switch.
His star was
always,
huge when he was doing Sojourn, and I don't think that he's gotten really any worse from that. But the way the fans react to him,
I think there might just be a taste change for the loudest people.
That could be.
And I've been amazed at some of the things people have pulled from, like, you know, movie captures and magazines, and did like comparisons between Land and where he's taking his photo reference from, but seems to me that's an awful lot of work to like put together these montages of he took this from this and he took
maybe
from
that's
that
just artistically what he's shooting for.
Well, and I also think that, you know, in this day and age where people can trace your sources that way, like, you know, Alex Raymond, the great Alex Raymond, he swiped from great illustrators like John Legata. Like, you can find what he took this portrait of Dale and Flash, and this is from this Legata illustration side by side. But in 1950, people didn't have the internet, and they weren't tracking it down. And
now.
So shoot your own reference.
Yeah, it comes out on Wednesday by
Tony Harris. Shoot your own reference.
What about the Spanish artist or whatever that was covered in Time magazine that commented when Raymond used him as
a
bad guy? Because that's in the
right.
Tom Roberts, Alex Raymond, His Life and Art.
Right.
Nearly sold out. Buy it now.
Great book.
And don't put
ring me, Tom.
And don't put you know, religious country western singers in the Doctor Strange comic.
Not good.
In trouble. Well, it's, you know, and you make
I love Jackson guys too.
You make an interesting point about the internet. It's like, you know, awesome. Something comes out on Wednesday. By Wednesday night or Thursday morning, people are posting swipes on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, the whole David Mack thing that happened earlier this year. It was a piling on of this is from this, and this is from this,
and
this
I can't,
is from this.
You know, as much as I like David Mack, I want to defend him, but I really couldn't.
Yeah.
This looks bad.
Well,
and the guy can obviously paint and draw really well and tells a great story.
Yeah, was he a photo reference or was it other artists?
It was both.
Their swipes.
Both. From magazine covers.
There are a lot of people work in the style of, you know, they have an influence that's so
Yeah, this is really
it.
Hard.
But there are people like, I remember when Keith Giffen was doing Munoz. You know,
oh, yeah, sure, sure. Was, yeah, yeah.
You know, and eventually he just turned around and just left the style.
Yeah.
He got such bad press for it.
And I don't know if Giffen was like tracing off panels in that
case. Was absolutely in love with the guy's work.
Yeah.
Was, you know?
Well, I discovered that guy through Giffen, though.
Yeah.
So I credit Giffen for that. And you know, I was a dumb teenager, and yet he led me in that direction. So I'm cool with that. But I don't know if he was tracing off panels. On the other hand, someone like Wally Wood traced off other artists' panels. In fact, I think he would even like paste down an L. Williamson car and draw around it sometimes.
Swiped Prince Valiant in his
for
samples.
His audition page
for
replace Foster for Prince Valiant.
I think that's
so you're not saying this is a new innovation?
But no, it's just people can catch you.
Yeah,
it's like the weird moral relativism of like you think. Everyone wants to think that everything old was like this pure, like, and they're all these pure artists that
Wally Wood never did wrong.
From wood, and they're all
But Wally Wood would turn it into his own stuff.
Right.
It never looked like the reference.
Well,
it wasn't like a direct. He didn't steal the style.
Williamson didn't recognize it first. Like, he had to look at the panel and go, "Wait, this looks from." Wait a minute.
people will talk about you know, like,
it wasn't like he stole
stills.
His car. He just stole the image of a car he had drawn.
But people will talk about using.
I don't think they can put you in jail for that.
I think people, there's that one Bender. So
you're gonna get Hillary pissed off about this.
Yeah, you're talking about Wally Wood.
Okay, Steve.
You know, people will talk about using movie stills or whatever. Al Williamson and Archie Goodwin did a Secret Agent X9 sequence that took place. It was a riff on The Prisoner of Zenda. Al did the sword fight scene that was kind of the climax of that strip using photos from The Prisoner of Zenda. I mean, is that Is that a swipe? Is that plagiarism? Is that an homage?
I think it's a switch in fandom where people nowadays are way more concerned with the process.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Back in the day, it was all about the final product. If you got a final product that looked good, that was it. Nowadays, everyone wants to know how did you... Who edited this? Who wrote? How did you write this?
Is that a bad thing? Should we delete this episode?
I'm a process junkie, so
you can't let it get you too hung up. I think sometimes on I think we look back on stuff and we want to assign high art,
right?
Values to things that people who worked on it didn't assign that. Like when Eric Larson had that thing about Vince Coletta's inking, where it was like everyone rags on Vince Coletta. But you know what? His job wasn't to create these inking masterpieces. His job was to, like, ink something in 2 days. And that was his job to do, and that was what he did. And he wasn't thinking, I'm gonna ink this so that everyone throughout history can look at this great job.
And if you needed a hooker, Vince Coletta was the guy that you wanted to call.
But you assign values to stuff after it that you want things to live up to.
Hillary was going to correct me on the hooker thing.
Not true.
No, because Hillary will hook you up.
Hillary's parsing words here.
We're not too far from Motel Row on Lincoln Avenue, and you don't need me to hook you up. No, I was just going to say, there were other inkers at the time. Joe Sinnott also worked at Marvel and H. Kirby in that era, and no one accused him of erasing the backgrounds that Kirby drew. So, I wouldn't go out of my way to pick on Vince, I mean, the late Vince Coletta, but...
He seems to get... He's
a favorite punching bag.
You're an inker. What's your take on Vince Coletta?
He was not my... I mean, I read comics back then in the 60s, and he wasn't my favorite inker. But I remember thinking I liked him on Tales of Asgard, but not on the lead feature in Thor. Because in Tales of Asgard, his scratchy kind of pen style that he would use kind of added that old-timey feel to these sort of tales.
Right.
Whereas Thor was more of an action strip and bigger giant Kirby, splash page and stuff. And I would have rather had Sinnott for someone else. There were a number of inkers that would ink him better than Vince Coletta. Vince Coletta just softened a guy. I mean, Vince Coletta inked other people, but really Kirby was the guy he hurt because Kirby was dynamic, and Coletta's inks were not. They were scratchy.
Nobody gripes about Coletta on Don Heck.
Hey, Don Heck is a great ink. Heck's own inking is
nobody's griping. The two people that you'll hear people bitch about Coletta on are Kirby and Neil Adams. Otherwise, they're not bitching about him on, George Tuska or Don Heck or any of those guys. Well, I don't think that his line hurt the other guys quite as much.
Inking's a fascinating process because just the fact that it exists, that artists team up that way.
Right. Someone draws something and someone else is like,
it's nothing new that artists work together. They have studios and there were reams of people that would work on classical paintings, hundreds of years ago, but it's a little different now. These are like two independent artists who get together and hopefully make something that works, and I think it seldom really is a really integrated process. It takes a while to, like, I know I'm often inking something. I just ink a short story by this guy and a short story by that guy. You never quite get a handle on it.
I asked, talked to Andy Parks about this last year, I think, and asked him, what's the difference between inking Tony Moore and inking Phil?
Yeah.
And he goes, I know Phil's line so well. It's those guys have been, almost synonymous with each other for so long that it's really almost second nature, I think, for him to ink Phil Hester. And so I think he enjoys inking other people, but but there's just something about how he and Phil kind of share anyone, an aesthetic with that wine.
Was there ever anyone that you ever got that?
Oh,
that you ever
there's plenty of people that I've really loved to ink, but it's always a process of, say, if you're doing a mini-series, by the fourth issue you feel like, oh, I want to start over, because now I'm starting to get a feel for this guy.
No, this guy's...
It's just feel, you know. Very little of it is intellectual. I mean, you make a big choice early on if you're going to say, oh, I'm going to do more pen work than brush work, or I'm going to ink it, push it in that direction. But otherwise, it's the process. It's doing it every day, and you just get a feel for it. And after a while, you go, hey, it's happening, you know, in spite of me. It's looking better. Or I'm getting a feel for it.
But, you know, since we've also talked about coloring, the real tragedy about, and you can probably pinpoint better, Hillary, when this actually happened, but the tragedy with inking now is the inker has largely been marginalized into... I know the Kevin Smith movie...
The tracer.
That stereotype is there, but in some ways, pencilers are not leaving as much room for interpretation, and I think they're shortchanging the whole concept of the collaboration.
Really
when they specify every line weight, it just sucks the life out of what an anchor can bring.
It's interesting to look at Mike Norton's backups.
Did you see
the Jerry Ordway ink stuff?
Well, the Jerry Ordway, and then the Carl Kessel, and then who? You had brought some pages around.
He had some Garcia Lopez pencils that were loose, because I guess Garcia Lopez...
Well, no, we were talking about inking. We were talking about how...
Mike just threw a gesture and walked away. Yeah.
He's going to walk over to Walgreens and get a 40,
I think. Well, it's funny to look at it, because you look at Norton stuff with Ordway and then with Kessel, and it looks very different, but it's Mike Norton's storytelling style, but you can tell that he didn't give it. Ordway and Kessel have their thing that they're doing over Mike's storytelling and Mike's pencils, and it's not too oppressive where, I mean, when Ordway inks something, it looks
like Jerry Ordway.
Why you get Ordway. He looks like Ordway.
If Norton and Ordway are collaborating, is it Nortway?
Nortway.
Yes.
I should have waited until you were taking
Norsel.
A drink.
Or Norsel.
Hillary, just a little Norsel.
Was there ever... ever a pencil
with Caribbean Coletta? It's Coletta, but with a K.
Coletta.
Was there ever a penciler that you really wanted to ink over and never got the chance to?
I can't say that there's one penciler that I never had a chance to ink, but I'm sure there were 20 that I would have. That would have been fun.
What was the biggest thrill that you had? Maybe a one time chance to ink a guy.
I don't know. I mean, I've inked... the longest I was ever worked with one artist was inking John Bogdanov on Power Pack. And I loved his drawing, and that was a blast. And every page, I mean, the guy could draw beautiful stuff. And here's a guy who would actually photo reference a lot of stuff, but turned everything into a beautiful drawing. His characters had so much life. He was, in many ways, very cartoony.
I read those.
You did?
When I was a wee lad.
It was a fun comic.
Oh, yeah.
And Franklin Richards... The son of Reed and Sue, who was in that comic as a character at the time, John's drawings were based on his own son, who was that age at the same time, and they were these, like, it'd be like Franklin was sleeping on a couch, and you could see the love that John Bogdanov had drawn his own son in that page, and you wanted to get every little hair perfectly. You know?
And then you would destroy it.
Yeah, and then
you
I
would destroy
spill
that
the ink. But no, John was one of those guys where there really was anything for me to do but not screw it up. I mean, the drawing, I wanted to, you know, and it every penciler has different strengths, different weaknesses, and if someone's weaknesses are something that you as an inker have a strength in, you know, you want to compensate. You want to bring out or add something that isn't there, that's needed. But I know that when I was first inking and people would point to something of mine and say, man, you really changed this. And I go, no, I just inked it. I didn't understand that I was changing it. I was just seeing the drawing and inking it. I mean, I didn't really, it wasn't like, you know, I didn't erase the pencil and go, oh, this figure's wrong. I was just sitting.
No, was that? That was because the line weight wasn't indicated as tightly as it might be today. It was more like a Buscema, looser style of penciling. So you had to determine the line weight. Is that why that happened? Or
I match. Well, I don't want to get rude. No, it's probably just my own way of inking.
Yeah.
Adds. You can't help but add something to it. I mean, I know when I get, like, you know, after the sort of image style started, you know, with the you know, Jim Lee and Scott Williams kind of thing was going on, I'd get people that were penciling in that style, and it was really tracing, because I didn't know how to ink it. If I did my own style, anything close to my own style on top of that, I would just ruin it. So I had to just sort of try to ink all the little lines that were indicated instead of having a black shadow. Say there'd be a bunch of parallel lines or some cross-hatching, and I would just put them in there. I didn't know why they were there. I didn't understand why they were there. I thought, you could have just put black here and it would have been fine. But I just inked them in because of that.
Just do what you're told.
But I didn't get a lot of that kind of work because it clearly wasn't something I enjoyed, and they weren't looking. You know, I wasn't the inker that the penciler was looking for.
You inked Liefeld for a while, though, right?
Like, yeah, really? I remember. Mostly he hated what I did because I didn't. No. He had very specific idea of the kind of inking he wanted, and you know what his style looks like, and that's not how I ink. But I remember there was one page I drew. We were talking once, looking through pages, and a guy was coming around a corner, and I just put a really strong shadow cut across him, where the upper, from like the mid torso up was all in shadow, and side light maybe left on the face and everything. And he said, "Oh, but that's cool." Like that change that I made, he liked. But where I spotted black in other places, he didn't like it. He really liked the open line and the fine line approach. And you know, he's been very successful with it. I mean, he knew what he was doing. But I just, you know, that's when I think there's a certain range of style as an artist, as a collaborator. You can meet sort of halfway. But you get too far apart in terms of your styles, and you're either tracing, you know, or you can't ink it. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I
get someone that draws closer to what
right.
that guy does.
Yeah, I picture you as being someone who has a lot of respect for economy of line. Even though
you, Chris.
Tom
said that. Speaking as someone who knows nothing about economy of line.
Not that describes Wally Wood in any way. Wally Wood was extremely detailed.
But see, Wally Wood might be detailed, but Wally Wood's stuff was not detailed everywhere.
Yeah.
He would spot. You know, I see pages now and stuff where the colors are detailed everywhere, the pencils and inks are detailed everywhere, and I don't. You know,
just makes your ass tired.
Well, it doesn't make me want to read the story. I want to be led through a story, and if the table and the elbow and the phone are just as interesting as the expression on someone's face, the story is not worth reading.
Okay.
Well,
okay. Punctuation. He's making a point.
But it's
the only sound effect.
Can I help
the
you,
thing
sir?
That I don't understand, the thing that I don't understand about most of this is it's not about storytelling. Mm-hmm. Most of the things that I don't like about all the newfangled comics out there is it's all about the page or the drawing or the effect. It's not really about telling the story. The story is moving along. You're not supposed to study the 5,000 figures in the background.
It's one of the things I love about Mike's work. Mike is such a very good comic storyteller in his art. You know, Mike may not be the most flamboyant draftsman that's out there, but Mike knows how to tell stories.
Oh, Mike's flamboyant.
You saw the pictures with the feather boa?
Pictures? He's going to come over here.
But the thing about detail, what I want to say is it's not about not you having detail. It's about having negative space, using white and black to set that detail off when you want to focus on something. It's like Hitchcock saying he wouldn't use a close-up in every scene. You'd use it at the big scene when it was important. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything. And I look at most of these pages, there's people flying, you know, someone's talking and their elbow's coming out of the panel. they're not even punching somebody. It's like, well, okay, that's a powerful elbow gesture while you're talking.
Can I trace that back to Bern Hogarth and blame him for that?
Well, a lot of really talented artists do that stuff where they want to make something, quote, interesting.
Dynamic.
You know? I'm going to punch this
and
table.
It's like, you know,
that is your favorite and most hated scene.
I hate that scene.
You bring
Justice
that. You,
League Task Force all the time.
Yeah, explain this.
Insane as a child. There's a scene in Justice League Task Force. I remember when I was reading it as a kid. This drove me. There was like a mild argument at the table.
Welling. Yeah.
There was a mild argument amongst all the heroes, and then Captain Adam stands up and punches the table for no apparent reason, crushing the table.
And everyone just stands around going, wow, that seems
uncalled for. It's like this huge full page spread of his muscles rippling and him punching a table. Like, right, and it's, oh, I already have
talk.
I have all the covers. I have.
Stop it.
That's great comics right there. Yeah,
but I remember as a kid, I was just like, why did Captain Adam punch the table? I don't understand why we needed to have a full
that table. That table just kept looking at him.
Well, that was
it had to learn
comic,
its place.
I remember when Jim Shooter was editor-in-chief at Marvel, there was the rule where you had to have the characters show their powers before the big fight scene that happened later on, because there was always going to be that.
Cyclops blasts open the top of a soda can.
Well, right, the story would open. That's the kind of thing that would happen.
It's a danger room.
They'd all be the danger room scene, or Sue would sneak up on somebody in the kitchen in the Fantastic Four's mansion, you know, or whatever. It's just, you know, and it's like, why? Well, we had to demonstrate the powers. You can't just all of a sudden have the powers magically appear on page 23.
Yeah, because God knows you don't know what the invisible girl is going to be doing.
Well, no,
Tom,
let alone the human
they
torch.
They figured it out, and they put a little front page thing, like inside front cover, or maybe it was like a paragraph that ran on the first page that would explain who the characters were and what their powers were.
Invisible,
and then they didn't have to write these horrible exposition scenes.
Sure.
Where people would have to demonstrate, you know.
What's your favorite shooter quote or shooter rule? You've mentioned a few times.
Every
comic is someone's first.
Every issue should read as a first issue.
Invisible Woman. Name is not ironic. Would be the description. would
Mr. Fantastic. Name is ironic.
Mr. Fantastic, if he has stubble, it means he's been working too hard.
I understand.
And I like Mr. Fantastic, I might add.
I would say in many ways, I would agree with the basic idea. Most comics are not friendly to new readers. They're visually incredibly dense. The storylines are complicated. And it's hard to just pick up a comic and go, oh, this is inviting. I want to see what this is about. It's off-putting. You know, it's just like, I could never figure this out. The visual language is too complicated. No. You have
to say that, I figured.
Well, right, no, but if you're raised on comics, you're raised on comics. But if you come to it late,
you pick up your average
comic, and it would be kind of daunting for a non-reader. And you don't think so.
It's kind of like watching your first soap opera. You know, you get into it.
I think it's
you
taste. I think part of it is...
I think certain styles are more welcoming.
Yeah.
I think it depends on how you're... I'm sort of curious, like, thinking about how my parents raised me, what made me, like, attached to things like comic books, because...
You're blaming your parents now?
I blame my parents for almost everything. almost everything in my life.
I blame your parents for
the fact that I have
too.
I have all the... my house smells like old newspaper.
Well, speaking as someone who knows nothing about your parents, Tom, I feel terribly sorry for them at this moment.
Yeah, they
I want to know why your house smells like old newspaper.
It's all those
making
old
a nest. I thought you were making a nest or something.
I own every single issue of
JLA.
of the Tribune since 1950. I have them stacked in my living room.
Until they crush you.
And it's
you
not,
die.
It's not weird.
Alone.
Oh, come on. Come on.
It's quaint and charming.
So speaking of process, let's talk about lettering.
Oh, God.
dot, dot, dot.
I actually had some emails, but...
Well, how long are we?
We're gonna save those for next.
Isn't that
read one email. Read one email.
All right.
Let's give them something besides us talking about how comic books are made.
Yeah, we went off the reservation.
Oh,
like
God.
The first
I've got
line.
One that
kinda, we just proved it really is like sausages. You don't want to know how they're made.
It just tastes delicious after you've.
I've got one email that is kind of a salutation and a call out for somebody.
Hi, Chris. I'm glad I checked out Comic Shots at ifanboy.com.
Do you do any other podcasts, Chris?
Every Thursday morning.
Tom Cater's delicious sweet salsa.
And I have another email that has a question. So which one?
Oh, come on. Just read them both. Come on. One at a time.
Yeah, come on.
Read them both at the same time.
I want to give these people something fun for a change.
Tear it in half. I'll read one while you read the other at the same time.
Read both. I don't want to give them an hour of sad.
Chris, no more backwards guests. Just you and Tom.
This is from Tom. Not this Tom. Another Tom. Says, hey, as a fellow reader of horror, and he's addressing me. Hi, Chris. Because I read a lot of horror comics these days. Says, as a fellow reader
of
horror comics these
days. He's like School of Reading Emails here. He's like,
I'm setting it up.
You want to tell the fucking backstory?
You've got to use your powers.
Stop.
Yeah. Tell us more about you.
This is going to listen just like Around Comics number one. All right. Does Hackslash get enough love?
So is someone's first episode.
God, poor people. I know it lacks all the subtleties of Lock and Key, etc., but what a fun read. Seeley's having a blast writing these little bloodbaths, and it comes through on the pages. It's kind of the same thing that Fear Agent has going for it, and everybody loves that title, including me. But because Hackslash is a sexed-up horror genre book, it gets poo-pooed in the peanut gallery. Anyway, I just wanted to give the title a little bit of affection.
P.S. Check out Comic Shots at ifanboy.com.
So, yeah, I like Hackslash. I think Tom likes Hackslash.
I like Hackslash.
So, yes, it's a good
book. I like Tim Seeley.
We don't talk about it too much because Tim will get a really big head.
Oh, God. Have you ever seen him walk around?
I was going to say, he barely fits in the stores.
I know.
Read Hackslash. Okay. Here is the second email. This is from Brent Williamson. And by the way, you can email us at info@aroundcomics.com or email me at chris@aroundcomics.com.
Don't email me. I won't answer.
Yeah, Tom won't answer. Hey, Around Comics guys. Brent from Couchcasters in Bloomington here. I've got a pressing question. Pressing comics
question.
You just emailed
the fucking Crankcast.
Yeah. Since I've been listening to your show and all the shows in AC continuity,
what?
Crankcast, Devil and Me, Tom versus the JLA. It's one of your listeners, Tom.
That shit.
You have continuity.
I've gotten back into comics in a big way. I go to the library every week and pick up 2 to 3 trades or graphic novels, and you guys have helped me mature my taste from Spider-Man, Batman, Superman, etc., to things like Sandman, Fables, Robert Kirkman stuff.
Hey, never give up on the old stuff.
Ex Machina and other comics. They're great. I recently obtained some extra monthly income and was going to set up a pull list at my LCS. Phoenix Comics. trouble is,
I recently killed my mother.
He rifled through her drawers and took her pocket change.
I can start a pull list. I'm woefully ignorant of what monthlies to get. I'm a few years behind in my continuity, so the Final Crisis and Secret Invasion Hurricanes tearing through the big two universe kind of scare me. So if I were to pick up 4 floppies a month, what do I put on my pull list? Do I stick with the same stuff, or do I just buy different books every month? Thanks for the help.
You know what I would do? I would...
Did someone say Fear Agent?
Fear Agent?
Hillary Barton says Fear Agent.
Find a good store near you, if you live near a good store, and just go in and take a look. Like when people ask you to recommend something...
Especially for a pull list.
It's just like, if you have a pull, you can just drop it. Yeah. Just go in, and when he says, or do I have to just randomly pick? So, well, kind of. I mean, if you don't know what your tastes are.
You picked up Batman Superman this week.
I'm uncomfortable
week
with
on a
pull
walk.
List. Terminology.
You
want
to pull it?
It sounds too much like a circle.
Hillary, you want to pull this?
You're Around Comics. I used to think your emails were bullshit until they happened to me. You're in a small little less than town.
I walked in to sign up for a pull list. But I mean, it is really, if you're interested in buying monthly books, it is sort of a crapshoot.
Tom's pulling my list right now.
If you don't know what your tastes are, it is going to be there's stuff that a lot of... You can look at your top 10 selling books and pick 4 of those 10 and maybe you'll like those, but who knows? Who knows what your tastes are going to be?
Don't get too...
As Tom is pulling me, I'm listing to the left.
Yeah.
Find, if you're going to add four books to your list, find four books that you like that you want to make sure aren't sold out whenever you get to your comic shop on Wednesday or Friday or whatever, and put them on your pull list. Just make sure that they're there, and that way...
And maybe you, in 2 months you won't like it, then you pick something
and then
else
you drop it and you put something
don't
else
get
in
too,
there.
Don't get too hung up on... I see a lot of times when people say, recommend what I should buy, because they're like afraid they're going to buy a bad comic book. If you're going to get into comic books, guess what?
You're going to buy,
a bad comic book. There's no way to avoid it. At some point, you're going to think something's going to be really good, and you're going to pick something up, and it's going to suck. Mm-hmm. So it's going to happen at some point. So don't get too worried that you're making some huge misstep.
Would that be a suck and pull list?
Yes, there would be the suck list.
So
Hillary Barta's suck list, coming out from AroundComics.com. Tom Cater Salsa. Not on list. Tom Cater Salsa list.
All right.
I can see a few comics from here that
might
stop
be on
my
list. So stop being such a pussy and just pick up the 4 bucks. Okay, so you want me to hold your fucking hand? You want me to fly out to where you are?
All right. Well, I tell you,
do you want me to go out there?
Dear reader.
A disturbing end to the show, but let's go with it.
All right. Well, I tell you what. Let's wrap this puppy up. Hillary Barta, upcoming projects from you.
Oh, gee, I don't know if I can take the pressure now. I'm still drinking in Munden's Bar at comicmix.com.
Thank you, Dom.
Thank you.
Various Fear Agent.
Yeah, I have a few backups coming from Fear Agent. A few other things to be announced.
Nobel for that. Not until we get a name.
The Nobel Prize?
No.
Okay.
Nobel until you have a title.
Oh, you and the puns.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Wordplay Barta.
We're moving along now.
All right, Jason Malay?
Current issues of Rex Mundi from Dark Horse. Hillary showing. Also
I'm holding
online,
the comic up to the microphone.
Dark Horse. Tale the Canterville Ghost with Steve Bryant. That do we
classical
know
what, comics?
Classical comics.
I think it'll be out next fall
okay.
of 2009.
Munden's Bar at various times from comicmix.com and
hit the bell.
Hit the bell.
And since it's Mike Grella's done an interview on it, The Pilgrim should be coming out sometime in the next few months for comicmix.com.
Nice, going Mike Grell.
So
very nice.
Mike Grell is drawing that and. Hero when I was a kid, so I'm looking forward
you're
to working
busy.
That.
He saved you?
So, no, no.
He saved somebody. That,
artistic hero. It's
oh, okay.
kind of like, you know,
yeah,
sports
like
hero, artistic hero.
You have sports
real
hero, fireman,
yeah, right.
Police officer.
Yeah. Artistic hero.
And finally, Mr. Bryant.
Priest goes really
Athena Voltaire from Ape Comics.
Oh, yes, and Athena Voltaire.
Canterville Ghost from Classical Comics, when Jason said it's coming out, and I'm in the process of begging and pleading independent creators to let me do backup stories for them for free.
Cool.
Wow.
Okay, maybe not begging.
I wanted that
but
to
offering.
Be more like this.
Wah, wah, wah.
No whammy, stop.
All right,
that was a dead ringer.
I'm Tom versus the Flash, and Tom Caruso.
Nice. 11 o'clock comics every Thursday or Friday, whenever Vince gets done editing.
Angry Old Man Podcast. Listen to everyone complain about when they started making characters in color.
Chris, what if I want to make a good drink with my comics?
Yeah.
You can go to ifanboy.com every Thursday morning and read my column, Comic Shots, which combines booze and comics.
11 o'clock comics.
Wow.
If you feel angry about
it's
comics,
like
go to 11 o'clock comics.
Oh, I need to send you that link. Yeah. Hillary's got a blog with limericks of dead people.
Scatlovers.com.
All right. That's good. Leave us an iTunes music review, if you would.
Thank you.
Check out our sponsor, InStockTrades.com. Be good
Jesus
to your neighbors.
Christ, this is sick. How many fucking
Jerry Lewis telethon at the
end? I feel like we didn't give them enough
is that why these kids
to justify
are here?
It.
Okay.
You know, and we didn't even really talk about it. Thank you for listening to us for 200 episodes.
200 episodes!
You are sad. Not as sad as we are, though.
All right.
I've been here for a lot of those.
Oh, yes, you have. Almost,
Woo!
about 180 or something.
Yeah, you don't look a day over 189.
I can't wait until we're in the old folks' home doing episode...
episode 925.
And we're complaining, oh, I remember when comic books used to be 22 pages.
Back in the day when the episodes were good.
Yeah.
Remember whenever they were on paper?
Yeah. When they colored them on computers.
Remember episode 33? Huh, that was a humdinger.
Before you had to download it to your tiny devil box. Plays that demon music.
We will be back next Monday with another full-length episode. In the meantime.
And between time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll be everywhere in
and around
comics.
Bye now. Strip mine murder.
That's from last week.
Chris is killing people in a strip mine.
Expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2008.